Good morning, everyone. I still consider this an unspeakable privilege. So this morning we're doing Genesis 18 to 23, and let me read you a quote from Joseph Smith about the Bible. I believe in this sacred volume. In it, the Mormon faith is to be found. We teach nothing but what the Bible teaches. We believe nothing but what is to be found in this book. So the main topic of these chapters would, of course, be, if you've read them, the almost sacrifice of Isaac by his father, Abraham, an event that has troubled, confused, and wrenched the hearts of humans since it was known. But before we can talk about it, we should do some backstory. And I just can't help telling you this story, which has nothing at all to do with Abraham. So I know you all have stories about your grandchildren, but this one was special. So this is about Cole, who is 3. So he takes swim lessons, and the lifeguards were discussing the broken pool thermometer. And Cole says, quote, "Maybe Jesus knows how to fix it." And the lifeguard said, "Who?" And Cole said, "You know, Jesus, the guy in the sky." So, sorry, I just couldn't resist telling you that story. Break things up a little. Okay, Genesis. If you look at Genesis, you realize that it falls into two main sections, chapters 1 through 11 and 12 through 50, you know, to the end. So 1 through 11 is the early history of the world and man, the relation of the Hebrew race to other nations and how they connect their history with the entire world. The real history begins in chapter 12, and that is the call of Abraham, which begins a new epic. And it's an account of the lives of Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, and Joseph as they relate to the origin of the Hebrew race or Israel. So these chapters show the rise of the Hebrew nation from a religious point of view, and they show how God chose this family for his peculiar people and made with them his covenants and promises that were later fulfilled. So I don't know about you, but it's always been a mystery to me. Why choose Abraham? Why would God trust him more than any other man? I mean, why did the course of Revelation follow the line of Abraham's descendants rather than any other? Why not the Egyptians? They had already had pyramids for, you know, 1,000 years. Why Abraham? It makes you want to think about Abraham. So here was a human being, Abraham, who was tested over and over again. His life was full of tests, beginning when he's told to leave his homeland with his wife Sarai and his brother's son Lot and go to Canaan, this strange country where he remains the rest of his life. If I repeat what Diane said last week, I was out of town, but you could say it a lot of times, all this stuff. So, is she here? No, she's not. I was going to say she could raise her hand and say, "Did that?" Anyway. So, Abraham, And the tests, so he has these tests over and over again. He's asked to leave, and they climax with God asking him to kill his own son as a sacrifice. So here is the human being to whom God spoke constantly, a man for whom God was not an abstraction or an idol to be worshipped, but a real being with whom he spoke. So let's start with 18. Open your books. And this chapter is this beautiful little narrative. So three strangers appear out of the desert at Abraham's tent door. Abraham invites them in, he washes their feet, he feeds them a fatted calf, all those things that a Bedouin sheik would do as a host in the desert. They're angels, but Abraham doesn't know this yet. Entertaining angels unawares is a common motif in ancient literature. So like if you went to Judges 6, Gideon, I read this story again, is called by an angel to save Israel. And he says, "Alas, O Lord God, because I have seen an angel of the Lord face to face." And then there's also in Judges, Samson's birth, where an angel comes to his mother and she runs and tells his father. And then later he says that he knew not it was an angel. In Hebrews, Paul says this verse that you've heard, "Be not forgetful to entertain strangers, for thereby some have entertained angels unawares." So I could ask you, we could stop it on this, you know, for a long time. Are we awake? Are interruptions in our lives, the life itself, or just something that we're impatient about? Because you never know what's happening. So anyway, in this story, Abraham is nervous and garrulous, you know, he's just talk, if you notice, whereas the angels are really succinct, you know. So in ancient literature, the greater person is always the one who is succinct, and the lesser is too talkative. Does that ring a bell with us? Isn't that true? You get nervous and you're... So the men, verse 9, 18 and 9 of Genesis, said unto him, "Where's your wife, Sarah?" And he said, "She's in the tent." So how did the men know that what her name was, you know? And this, in this story, if you're just looking at it as literature, it makes it more interesting, because you think, are these supernatural beings? You know, it causes interest. So the three messengers tell Abraham in verse 10, "We will return in a year, and by that time, your wife will have had a child." Well, what happens back in the tent? Sarah hears it, you know, of course she's listening. Verse 12, and she laughs. And then later in 15, the men said, "You laughed," and she denies it and says, "No, I didn't." And they said, "Yes, you did." But, you know, why not laugh? She was 90 years old, I think. But then this beautiful verse 14, they say, "Is anything too hard for the Lord?" Which is exactly what the angel Gabriel says to Mary in Luke. when they tell her she's going to have a baby. With God, nothing is impossible. So we get in verse 21 of this little story that precedes the fall of Sodom and Gomorrah, the reason for the visit of the three angels. God is assessing the wickedness of Sodom and Gomorrah. He says, I will go down now and see whether they have done all together what I'm hearing they have done. But before that, if you look up the page in verse 17, you get these two beautiful verses. And this is about God and Abraham. And the Lord said, shall I hide from Abraham what I'm about to do? Seeing that Abraham shall become a great and mighty nation, and all the nations of the earth shall be blessed in him. For I know him, that he will teach his children. That beautiful phrase, I know him. I know what he'll do. I know Abraham. So God can trust him because he's righteous. In the Pearl of Great Price, I'm sure Diane read these verses where it says in Abraham 1 and 2, verse 2, Abraham, and we've read them at least 10 times, desiring to be one who possessed great knowledge and to become, and these are the phrases I love, a greater follower of righteous and to possess greater knowledge. So here is Abraham always seeking. So Abraham becomes known as the friend of God. And that is, I found three places in 2 Chronicles 20 and 7. It says, Abraham, thy friend forever. Isaiah 41 and 8, thou Israel, whom I have chosen, the seed of Abraham, my friend. And James 2 and 23, Abraham believed God, and he was called the friend of God. Isn't that beautiful? Wow, to have that be said of you. So you get to chapter 18, 23, the men start walking toward Sodom. And what starts happening, if you've read this, you know, Abraham starts trying to intervene in behalf of Sodom and Gomorrah. His nephew Lot is there with his family, so maybe that's part of it. But I don't think it's all of it. So Abraham is really careful not to offend God. Look at verse 27. He says, now God, I know I'm just dust and ashes. Don't be mad. But if there's only 50, will you save them? And then he starts bargaining him down. And he says, verse 30, oh Lord, don't be angry with me, but what if there's only 30 people? And then, you know, it's interesting when we will read Jeremiah later, if we're all still alive by then, we're going so slow. That's my fault. Jeremiah is not quite like this. He is not as afraid of God. So I want you to keep this back in your heads. He shakes his fist at God and yells at him. But Abraham is a different, you know, personality. He says, don't be mad, but what if there's only 10? Will you save them? You know. So he gets his promise, right? No, he doesn't. The sad thing is, there aren't even 5 people. righteous people. There's such interesting things to think about here, and if we were in a small room, we could yell them out, but here's one. If you look back in 21, isn't it interesting that God has not yet passed sentence yet on Sodom? So Abraham could have made a difference, right? He says, I will go down and see. So here is one question. Is God influenced by our prayers? Would he have been influenced by the intervention of a good man? Perhaps changed his mind. Does our repentance, our will, our free will change God's mind? Well, it would appear from here that it could. Other places, you know, Samuel, he says no. But it wouldn't bother me if he gave to man enough free agency that they were like his friend, he and Abraham. So Abraham bargains with God. Here's another thing. He knew what God was like because he was like himself. Abraham knew God was like himself, that he would be merciful. He thought, I can bring his mercy out of him. He knew God's nature. He knew he had a chance. But Abraham also knows what's going on in Sodom, so it's not to be, is it? So even though God is slow to anger and of a great kindness, he's also a righteous God. And I suppose that Abraham learned that even though God prefers mercy, he is a just God. You know, people are sometimes uncomfortable with the idea of the God they see in the Old Testament. If you are uncomfortable, raise your hand. You can do it, it's okay. So I am also sometimes. Daniel Peterson, the BYU professor, who writes his columns in the Deseret News, wrote these things. He wrote that so many of us want a God who is non-judgmental and always accepting, a comfortable pal who would never condemn nor exclude anybody, someone we can hang out with and be comfy. But to portray God's judgment as unloving is a grievous distortion. But to depict his love as holy, non-judgmental, is a dangerous one, because he is both merciful and just. So this is still Daniel Peterson. We often, he says, want to think of the Book of Mormon portrayal of Jesus among the Nephites, where he's compassionate, not killing anybody, instead of the Old Testament God who's angry and created by people who blame on him all their evil impulses, right? But what happens in the Book of Mormon right before Jesus appears? You remember? There's a bit of destruction going on. That great city of Zarahemla have I burned with fire and the inhabitants thereof. That great city of Moroni have I caused to be sunk in the depths of the sea and the inhabitants thereof drowned. That great city of Moroni have I covered with earth. Then he identifies himself. Behold, I am Jesus Christ, the Son of God. So sometimes we see what we want to see, right? Elder Holland said, It's a characteristic of our age that if people want any gods at all, they want them to be gods who do not demand much, comfortable gods, smooth gods, gods who pat us on the head. And in C.S. Lewis's memorable image, he's not a tame lion. Don't you love that? Which is why I brought my tame lion. So you have to imagine Aslan, right? He's not a tame lion. God is not a tame lion. So that was all to say. We should leave our minds open for the God of the Old Testament and think about what's there, maybe what's not there, but not be too judgmental ourselves. Anyway, so back to Abraham. Look at him trying to save these people, this good man going to bat for these people in this terrible city. So what is going on in Sodom? Like I said, chapter 19 is basically a sequel to 18. The two angels now go to Sodom and they walk in, and they approach the town, and Lot, who is a person of authority, obviously, because he's standing at the gates, right? And that's where they would sit. He sees these two men and he insists on taking them home. You can read it. And they say no, and he says, yes, you must come home with me. Why? Why does he need to take them home? Because of what will happen to them if they are on the streets all night. He knows perfectly well what's going on. And so he takes them home, verse 6. He puts them in the house and shuts the door. And then what happens? All these men come, every man, it says, in the whole city, and surround his house, yelling that he bring out the men, that they, verse 5, that we may know them, which in biblical terms means what? Intercourse, right? Sexual intercourse, that we may know them. So you can start guessing what's going on in Sodom. So then you get verse 8, this really terrible verse. He says, I've got two daughters who are virgins. Take them instead. I'm not going to dwell on this because elsewhere in the Old Testament, and soon when we get there next week with Diane, there is a big deal made about a woman's honor. Wait till you read about Dinah. And certainly Joseph Smith did not think this is what happened. So I'm just going to move on and not, and put that up on the shelf, as we do sometimes. The two angels, the men, pull Lot into the house and slam the door. And then they strike all the men with blindness that are out there. And then they tell Lot, verse 17, you get out of here and quick. And don't look behind you. Don't stay on the plane. And they had told him to go and get his family. So Lot tries to get his sons-in-law, and they won't come. They laugh at him. They won't believe him. So he goes back, and they go out. Lot says, I can't go up in the mountain. I want to go over to Zoar, this little town, instead. And then verse 24, and the Lord rained upon Sodom and Gomorrah brimstone and fire out of heaven and destroyed them to the ground. And then this really famous verse, but his wife looked back, Lot's wife, from behind him and became a pillar of salt. So that's the basic story, right? So what was happening there in Sodom? If you Go to Ezekiel 16. It explains what was happening. Isn't this interesting in Ezekiel? So 16:49, this is on page 1046. This is an important verse. I'm having you look it up. Behold, this was the iniquity of thy sister Sodom, and here it is, pride, fullness of bread, and abundance of idleness was in her and in her daughters. Neither did she strengthen the hand of the poor and needy, and they were haughty and committed abomination before me. So they were sexually corrupt, they were idle and lazy, they ignored the poor and the needy, and they were arrogant and entitled. Don't you wonder in your own mind which of these terrible things is worse to God? I do, often. I think it's such an interesting question, but we're not going to stop on that. So here's the question, though. Why would Lot want to live in such a place? Because he chose to live here, right? Back in chapter 13, it says he pitched his tent toward Sodom. This was when he broke off with Abraham, right? There was not enough room for all their flocks together. Lot picks the plain. Abraham picks the mountain. Why did Lot pick such a terrible place? Well, I think it's probably safe to assume he wanted to go there for worldly gain, maybe. I don't know, it doesn't say. Probably wanted to be rich, be comfortable, have influence. But, you know, he may have become an important man in Sodom, but he lost his family. Later, we know that his daughters get him drunk and have incest with him. So everything's kind of screwy, isn't it, for him in his life. So Lot's wife, we have to just stop on Lot's wife, right? Most people agree that when it says that Lot's wife looked back, really, she went back. She couldn't do it. Maybe she couldn't leave her stuff and her life. I don't know. So I brought my salt, the salt over there. In Luke 17, Jesus alludes to the fate of Lot's wife as a warning to his followers against clinging too closely to the world. So that's why we start to think maybe she went back. He said, this is Jesus' words, "Remember Lot's wife, whoever shall seek to save his life shall lose it." And then the rivers, right? I can't remember where I read this, but I think it's true. That Brigham Young, when he left Nauvoo and the temple burning, said, "Let it burn." I just love that. He was moving his face ahead. But you know, there are different ways of looking back. We've just talked about one. Another one is that we cling to sins, right? It's so hard to give up all our stuff and our ways. Sometimes they paralyze us and we become entangled. We just learned that one of our missionaries was just shot dead in a gang war in California. This is Elder Joshua Tonga. A wonderful boy who was in a gang before his mission and went back. He turned back. And, you know, we have these little things I kept, you know, where they, when they would arrive, they would write their testimony. So here's Elder Tonga with John and I, smiling, you know. But you should read this. It's educated, it's well written, it's full of love. I'm grateful for the gospel and for all the happiness it has brought into my life. So, I don't mean to get really personal, but sometimes we need these things to remind us not to look back. Okay, as usual, there are many layers of meaning in these stories, but in this one, you know, this is what is in my head. It's to ask ourselves, where do we want to live? Where do you want to live? Do you want to live in the world, or do you want to live in the spirit? And what does that mean? Listen to Proverbs 30 and 7. I just love this. Two things have I required of thee. Deny me them not before I die. Remove far from me vanity and lies. Give me neither poverty nor riches. Feed me with food convenient for me, lest I be full and deny thee and say, who is the Lord? Or lest I be poor and steal and take the name of my God in vain. So here's a really beautiful quote from a man named William Henry Channing, who was born in 1810. He was a preacher. To live content with small means, to seek elegance rather than luxury, and refinement rather than fashion, to be worthy, not respectable, and wealthy, not rich, to study hard, think quietly, talk gently, act frankly, to listen, await occasions, hurry never, and then this is the part, to let the spiritual, unbidden and unconscious, grow up through the common. This is my symphony. Isn't that beautiful? Okay, chapter 21. We're going to skip 20 in the interests of time. Sometimes it's really tempting to read a lot into these accounts, but I feel it's not important, that it's important that we don't do that. However, these stories are so incredibly compact, aren't they? You're reading along and there's these levels going on. They're so skillfully told. So here's a question. Why are these stories preserved and more important than other stories that are preserved? Like, I could name you a few, the Odyssey, you know, that these ancient stories, the Cinderella story appears over and over again, the Hamlet story. So, why are these more important? It's okay. Here's why. Because man has believed that God's word is in these stories. That's why they're important. And because, and this is the real one, the Bible is always asking the question, where are we with God? Where are you with God all the time? So that said, these chapters are full of human pain, suffering and loss, chapters 21 and 22, full of what it is to be human and to be human and struggling with God. So here we go. In fact, Israel means I have struggled with the Lord, the word Israel. So these are about these chapters, Sarah, Hagar, and Benjamin, Abraham. So 21, 1 through 5, Sarah gives birth to Isaac. Abraham is 100 years old. And in verse 6 of 20, she says, or 21, she says, God hath made me to laugh. She names him Isaac, or he is named Isaac. Or in the revised version, God hath made laughter for me. And Isaac means laughter. So this is a picture that Ashley brought of Sarah holding her baby, Isaac. Isn't that lovely? She offered to bring that. So then in 21 and 9, you get this really sad verse in the beginning of all the trouble that follows. It says, and Sarah saw the son of Hagar, the Egyptian, which she had borne unto Abraham, mocking. So Ishmael and Isaac are playing, the mothers are watching, and Sarah sees Ishmael, who is older than Isaac, making fun of him. And this is weird, but people trace the whole Arab-Israeli problem back to this verse. Seems a lot, but you can see how things get, you know, pushed back to a point. So we already know from Genesis 16 that after Hagar conceives, Sarah was despised in her eyes. Because why? She was childless, right? So now you have this little boy lording himself over Isaac. So here is Hagar, the Egyptian slave, and she was a slave. She probably was part of the property that Abraham received from the Pharaoh when all that happened earlier. So, and here is Hagar, the slave girl that Sarah gave to Abraham so he can have seed. It was done exactly according to the code of Hammurabi, that great Babylonian law code of Mesopotamia, that you could give your slave woman to your husband and it would be your child, right? This is like everybody knew it was okay. So you have to have this in your head, what's happening. Sarah has been childless. Hagar has had a baby. Now Sarah has had Isaac. What are the underlying, you know, dynamics going on? Sarah never refers to Ishmael or Hagar by name. She always calls them the slave woman in other translations, or the bond woman, or the son of the slave. So in 21 and 10, she says, after this mocking incident to Abraham, cast out this bondwoman and her son. For the son of this bondwoman shall not be heir with my son, even with Isaac. So Abraham, it says in 11, is grieved because of his son. Not because of Hagar, because of Ishmael. But God tells him, look at this, verse 12, in all that Sarah hath said unto thee, hearken unto her voice, for in Isaac shall thy seed be called. Listen to what she said. She's right. Interesting. And so, Abraham sends Hagar and Ishmael out. But God is merciful to Hagar and Ishmael. He promises that Ishmael will become a great nation. And he does. It's the beginning of the Arab nations. Both great nations, children of Abraham, as well as one other great people, who? The Christians, us. So the next time we see Ishmael and Isaac together is in chapter 25 when they bury Abraham, these brothers. But it's through Sarah's lineage that the promise had to come. So one thing I love about the Old Testament is that it never tries to whitewash its characters. Do you agree? Look at what's happening here. Sarah isn't perfect. Hagar isn't perfect. And I don't even think Abraham is all that perfect. He kind of stands back and lets them do it. So in this really pretty heartbreaking story, you identify with all three characters, really, I think. But Sarah knew what she had to do. We talked about her death 3 weeks ago and how Abraham came to weep. This is in chapter 23, where he buys the burial cave. You know, I read that her death was like a tall tree falling. Here she was, Abraham's wife, who went through everything with him, left the richness of Ur of the Chaldeans, went out in this long adventure of the spirit, always moving around in a foreign land, all those years of bitter disappointment at childlessness. She shared with him the joy and pride of Isaac's birth, was beautiful, was a beautiful woman of great passion and nobility, I think. And her name, along with Abraham's, was also changed. So I don't want you to think I think ill of her at all. But I just love these stories because you don't just hear everything's all roses, right? I heard this little thing on NPR on the radio about great pairs. A man has written a book. I haven't looked it up, but he was talking about great pairs and how all great things have arisen out of relationships. So he named George Lucas and his wife, his first wife, who really created Star Wars, was the editor, and then he named Vincent Van Gogh and his brother Theo, who both of them said had to be there for the art to be created. And I can think of so many others, Marie Curie and her husband Pierre, and anyway. The problem, this man said, is not that one gets more credit, but that we forget the collaboration. We know so little about the offstage person. Isn't that true? So there's this medieval English play called Abraham and Isaac by a man named Brome. And when Abraham has led Isaac out to sacrifice him, and Isaac has just learned what is about to happen, Isaac cries out, and you know, I don't know Middle English, but I'm gonna do a little bit. Now I would to God my mother were here on this hill. She would kneel for me on both her knees to save my life. So you're probably wondering what this is all about. These are my great-grandparents, Archibald Frame and Helen Dick Frame. So I'm going to just, I know you all have your own ancestors, but I'm going to tell you a little story about these two. So Helen, who was my great-grandmother, married her best friend's brother. So her best friend, Janet, and she, and they all lived, and so Helen married David Dick, and her best friend, Janet, married Archibald, the guy over there. They all lived in Aberdeen, Scotland, and they joined the church, and Helen's parents disowned her, and I don't know exactly what happened to the others, but they all left and emigrated to Zion. And Helen had seven children. I looked it up, Mom. It's not five, seven. We're discussing. And Janet and Archibald had 11 children when Helen's wife, her husband, died and left her with all these children, who was Janet's brother, right? Is that clear? Anyway, so here's this woman in the early or late 1800s left, which was a hard thing in those days. So Janet and Archibald, the other wife, brought them into the Archibald home, the Frame home, so that she could live. And there were four rooms, and so they were in these other rooms, I guess, and 15 children. Then one day, Janet, her best friend, wrote a note to her husband, Archibald, and said, "You should take Helen as your plural wife, because I want you to raise my brother's children." And so he did, and they had one child, who was my grandmother. So all these children, she had all these sisters and brothers in this big happy family, and he built her a little house. So when Janet died, Helen's best friend, Archibald went and put the note, which he had kept secret, in her hand in the coffin. Now to me, we don't know why, but to me it's saying, "Janet, you were the wife of my youth, and I love you. And I only did all this because of you." So, you never know people's hopes and dreams. Abraham, Hagar, Sarah. So, we only have 10 minutes on the, probably the biggest chapter in all the Old Testament, which is Abraham taking Isaac up to Mount Moriah. So it says, 22:1, that God did tempt Abraham, which also means try or test. And he said, verse 2, "Take now thy son, thine only son Isaac, whom thou lovest, and get thee into the land of Moriah, and offer him there for a burnt offering upon one of the mountains, which I will tell thee of." So this is one of the most beautifully told and moving stories in Genesis. Like I said, this, so many people have written about this. If you had to take philosophy, that Kierkegaard wrote Fear and Trembling, the whole thing about this incident, and so many people. It's a strange story. I mean, Abraham must have, he had the same thing almost happen to him. He must have abhorred human sacrifice. But at the time, it was an actual custom among the Canaanite tribes. It had been practiced for centuries. If you look in 2 Kings, the king of Moab, who is being in battle, takes his oldest son up on the walls of Moab and kills him, sacrifices him. So Abraham would have known it was not acceptable to God, but he never hesitates. He, verse 6, puts the wood on Isaac's shoulders. He takes the fire in his hand and the knife and climbs the mountain, which is really a hill. And then verse 7, and Isaac spake unto Abraham and said, my father, and he said, here am I, my son. He said, behold, here's the fire and the wood. Where is the lamb? And Abraham says, God will provide. And verses 9, he builds an altar. He lays Isaac down. He lifts up the knife. And the angel speaks. So this story is a type of the sacrifice of the son. Jacob in the Book of Mormon says, chapter 4, verse 5, it is a similitude of God and his only begotten son. So even without Jacob telling us, we can see the symbolism. You know, you've got Isaac, who is a type of Christ, who was, as Paul says, obedient unto death. And Paul calls Isaac the only begotten son. Abraham lays the wood on Isaac's shoulders, so you can see the parallels, right, with Christ and his cross. Abraham is a type of the father who, Paul says again, spared not his own son in Romans. And the ram is a type of the substitution of Christ for us. Similitude means that the thing corresponds to some greater spiritual reality. So, what is the greater spiritual reality happening here? That's the question people have tried to discern. Spencer Kimball, President Kimball, said, contradictory, irreconcilable, impossible, and yet he believed God about Abraham. So what is the spiritual reality? Why is Abraham asked to sacrifice Isaac? I personally don't think there are any easy answers. You know, maybe you've heard them, but here are some of my thoughts just quickly. I read that this whole episode must be seen much more as the history of the soul than only as a test for Abraham. In other words, we have to look inside. It is the history of Abraham and Isaac, but you have to examine your own soul, because it always comes down to us, right? Could I have done it, is what you have to ask. Am I, like Abraham, capable of going to the farthest point of consecration? Capable of paying the utmost price? You know, you could say maybe Abraham didn't think God would go through with it, or maybe God would bring Isaac back to life. Surely he wouldn't want me to kill the very son through whom the covenant was promised. I mean, Abraham had, but he couldn't be sure, right? He couldn't know. He had given up so much, you think, I've already talked about it, and now his son. We worry sometimes about the ethics of it, but as Mormons, you know, all we have to do is look at Nephi and Laban, right? And our minds should be a little more open, and we think, is it ethical? But where do we get our ethics from? There's a question. So, when Abraham says in verse 8, God will provide, the Hebrew is, God will see. And what is it that God will see? faith is not blind. Faith is sight. So before Abraham leaves, he names this place, verse 14, Jehovah Jireh, it shall be seen. What is happening is the Lord sees into Abraham. And what does Abraham see? Next week, when we talk about Jacob, we will see that Jacob has this dream where he sees angels, you know, going up and down the ladder, and he calls it that place, the gate of heaven. That is what Abraham sees, the gate of heaven. Because he sees beyond the suffering and the loss and the pain that is there at the point of human existence. And what does he see instead? I think he sees the joy of loving God. And we could, you know, talk about that a long time. That he's consecrating, this is just my opinion, he's consecrating even human love to God. Because I think when we really give up without flinching what we love or hope for to God, he will always give us something better. And I don't think you can do that kind of thing just on obedience, because it stops. Your will stops. It's got to be out of joy, out of love. So I have to just read you this thing quickly. This incident happened in Massachusetts. You know, the Jews at the end of the year, they have this what's called a Simchat Torah, after they read the whole Torah, which is what we're doing, and then they have this meeting and they dance, and it goes on for hours and hours. And there was a refusnik, remember that word, from Russia, who had come over to the States and was at this one rabbi's dancing, and the rabbi was so thrilled about his celebration, and he asked this Russian Jewish refusnik what he thought about their Simchat Torah. And the man said, well, it's okay, but it's better in Leningrad. And the rabbi was a little bit offended, you know, and said, why? He said, because, and this was years ago, but in Leningrad, if you dance in front of the synagogue on Simchat Torah, you must assume that the secret police will photograph everyone. This means that you will be identified. And since your dance is considered anti-Soviet, you must be prepared to lose your job. And so you see, to dance on such an occasion, this is a different kind of dance. And that is Abraham. So our time's up, but some other time I'll talk to you about Mount Moriah in Jerusalem. But I did want to ask you, I've just been in at this beautiful little church in Maui, and if Shirley's here, I wanted to, anyway, she's probably not here, she had to leave early, my friend that we took over. There's this little church called Hui Aloha down between Kipahulu on the east side of Maui and Kula and the Kaupo Gap, and you go down, it's this little white church, and you go down there, it's an old congregational church that was built in 1859, and it's so beautiful, and we all felt it, this peace, that this was a holy place. So let me ask you, do you have a holy place in your life? Do you have a place where you can live in the Spirit? So there are lots of questions we haven't asked. Like, here's just a little thing. Why was it a ram in the thicket? Why not a lamb? That's a question I have. A ram is a male sheep, right? Why not a lamb? I read this thing that I don't know if I can find it, but that the Jews say, oh, here it is, that the ram was put in place from the day of creation to save mankind. Well, this was, as a Mormon, I have never heard that. This is a Jewish tradition. So we know who that ram was, right? It was Jesus Christ, the Holy One of Israel. But why was it a male ram? That's just a little niggling question you can ask yourselves. Let me just end with this piece from Psalm 139. Wherever I make my bed, he says, David, God will be there. Even if I were to take the wings of the morning and dwell in the uttermost parts of the sea, his hand would hold me. Even in darkness, the night shall be light about me. Yea, the darkness hideth not from thee, but the night shineth as the day. We've been with some folks who buried their son deep into the earth. And I think the night shineth as the day, even there. In the name of Jesus Christ, amen. Mm-hmm.